see you in this midweek. And we'll get the sound adjusted properly here in just a moment, I think. But so glad to see everybody this midweek, and privilege it is to come out and study God's Word together tonight. Thank you for being here. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 11 tonight. We've been actually looking at it the last couple of class periods, and we're down at about verse 32. We've been looking at the writer's explanation and definition of what faith is all about. It's the substance of things hoped for, a conviction, evidence of things not seen. And he's been showing us that without faith, it's impossible to please God. If you come to God, you must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those that seek Him. He's been showing us that faith is something that acts. Over and over again, we've seen actions by faith. Starting early on in the chapter, we see that Abel did what by faith? Abel offered a what? More excellent sacrifice than Cain. What did Enoch do? He had testimony that he pleased God. Okay? That he pleased God. And he walked with God. He was translated. He was not. And then we think about, what did Noah do? By faith, Noah built an ark to the saving of his household. And then we talked about Abraham leaving Ur of the Chaldees. Sarah receiving strength to have a child in her old age. Abraham being willing to offer sacrifice his son of promise, accounting that God was able to raise him up from the dead. We've seen what the patriarchs did by faith. You think about Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, all of whom said things about the future of their children that they were putting in the hands of God, I think is a great testimony of faith. And then we come down to the parents of Moses. What did they do by faith? They hid Moses and didn't fear the king. They were going to save this beautiful child. And then Moses himself, when he was of age, when he came of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer reproach and affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. So all of these people have this great testimony of faith, showing us what faith is, that faith is something that trusts God so implicitly and so completely, and yet it causes you to act. You don't just sit here and say, yes, I trust God. It's not just a mental assent to who God is and what He's able to do, but it is a complete trust that causes you to act in such a way that to look on it from the outside, it might seem irrational. It doesn't especially seem rational that Abraham leaves his homeland to go to a place he doesn't even know where he's going. Doesn't seem rational to build a boat in a place where there's not an ocean particularly, but maybe that's about what Noah did. Maybe it doesn't seem rational to get ready to kill your son through whom you're supposed to be the father of a multitude of folks, and now you're going to kill this. But by faith, we do things that otherwise might not seem rational. But you see, we have a conviction about who God is. We have trust in Him, and even things that we cannot see or cannot understand, we trust Him. So the Hebrew writer's been very diligent at showing us all of these examples. And we come down to Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 32, and he says, "What more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens." These are all great examples of faith. You go on in verse 35, "Women received their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth." What tremendous description of people of faith is given to us in this text. And he's talking about, of course, a lot of Old Testament characters. He mentions Gideon and Barak and Samson, Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets. And he says about them that, among other things, that they subdued kingdoms. In the list of names even that he gives us, Gideon prevailed against the Midianites, okay? And Barak and Deborah prevailed against Canaanites led by the army of General Sisera, you might remember. Samson, Jephthah rose up and stood up against the people of Ammon in the book of Judges. So you have all of these examples of people who subdued kingdoms. They worked righteousness. They did the right thing even when doing the right thing was difficult. I expect that a prophet like Elijah was not an easy thing to do the right thing in his day and time, but he does the right thing. And over again, these people are willing to do that and to obtain promises. They stopped the mouths of lions. I can think of at least three examples where the mouths of lions were stopped by great people of faith. Can y'all think of them? Samson, David, Daniel. Very good. You get the gold star tonight, Freddie. Samson, remember him? He meets a lion coming down the road and he just takes it out. And David said he did the same thing. Both the lion and the bear came up against him. And of course, Daniel's thrown in the lion's den and the mouths of the lions are stopped. And so all of these men trust God. Daniel actually doesn't do anything. He's thrown in the lion's den. He goes ahead and prays even though he's going to be thrown in the lion's den. So that's an act of faith. But the point is, all of these men were able to face the lion. I can tell you, having been in Africa this last year and on the way home starting to read a story about man-eating lions, that would be something that that takes a lot of faith, I think, to stand up against a lion. They quenched the violence of fire. I think of Daniel chapter 3 and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they escaped the edge of the sword. There are several examples of that. But I might think of 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 9 and 10, when Elijah gets to Horeb and he tells, he's talking to God and he tells God about, you know, how they're seeking to take his life and he's escaped. The prophets are being killed by the sword and he's escaped that. And out of weakness we're made strong. Who's an example of that? Samson's an obvious one who was strong to begin with, granted so by God, and then lost that strength, and then out of weakness again was made strong by his faith and trust in God. Became valiant in battle and repelled alien armies. Now, that would apply to a lot of the judges and people in that time frame. David, certainly, over and over again. Jonathan, yeah, a lot of people you can think about. And you know, the point is, these were real people in life and death situations, facing real enemies who were striving to take, you know, might take them out. And you have people like Gideon, who here he is. The Midianites are overrunning the land. He's at first not very brave. You might remember when the story opens up with Gideon that he is actually threshing wheat in a wine press, kind of down in a hole, in order to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel comes and addresses him, mighty man of valor. And it's almost humorous, you know, to see how the angel addresses him. Here he is hiding in a hole, basically, away from the Midianites. But he turns into a mighty man of valor. And you think about the conquering of that huge Midianite army with 300 men, just out of complete faith and trust in God, that God would give him the victory. What a valiant man he was. And, of course, gained the reputation along that line. And women received their dead again, raised to life again. I can think of a couple of examples of that, both in the lives of Elijah and Elisha. You might remember the widow at Zarephath who cared for Elijah when he was there, and her son died, and Elijah brought him back to life. And then Elisha had a sort of similar situation with a Shunammite woman who had a child that was sort of a child of promise to her, and he died, and Elisha came along and brought him back to life as well. Well, all of these things, tremendous things, again, happen in real lives of real people, and they demonstrate to us how faith really works and what tremendous things can be accomplished by people who don't believe necessarily in the impossible, but believe that with God, all things are possible. That's what you see in these lives of faith. we're called to live by faith. To believe that with God, all things are possible. We trust Him. We're doing His will. This is the kind of life that we're called to live as well. And I hope that we can see that in what's being said to us in Hebrews chapter 11. It's not just the glorification of all of these people, but as we get to the end of the chapter in a minute, it will be the challenge for us to be like these people and even to go beyond the kind of faith that they had and complete their race for them, as we'll see in just a minute. Well, we think about some of the other aspects that we've read, and what are some things that they were willing to go through as we look at the end of verse 35 and through 38, which I already read. Notice that, I can get this to move, not only did they do great things by faith, but they were willing to endure persecution and hardship of all different kinds. It mentions them being tortured, did not accept their deliverance in order to obtain a better resurrection. You know, when you're being, just imagine being tortured and being tortured to death, when, you know, the guy says, okay, well, if you'll just bow down to Baal, I won't kill you here, or whatever it is, and you refuse to do that, believing that in the life to come, that's true faith. We think about martyrs, you know, from the time of Christ onward. There were apparently a lot of martyrs in Old Testament times as well. Certainly, again, I was mentioning the time of Elijah, when many, many prophets were slain through the work of, you know, Jezebel. And there were other periods in Israelite history where that was true as well. If you wouldn't worship Baal or some of the Asherahs or whatever, then you're going to be taken out. Tremendous amount of faith to face death. In fact, I think that's faith at its greatest challenge, isn't it? When we face death for our beliefs. And there are people here who are willing to do that and be tortured, looking forward still to the resurrection. It mentions them being mocked and scourged, which is the idea of being beaten with a whip and chained and imprisoned. And you have Old Testament characters, certainly, who experienced that kind of thing. Jeremiah, who would be a good example of those kinds of things, we call him the what prophet? Anybody know? The weeping prophet. He had a lot to cry about, didn't he? He had a lot to cry about because of the situation of his nation and what was going to happen to them. But he had a lot to be sad about concerning his own personal life as well. Among other things, he was thrown in a pit at one point, just kind of left there for a time being. In Jeremiah chapter 20 and verse 2, you can read about him being beaten and put in stocks in a public place. You see these old-time, medieval-type movies about medieval times and all that sort of thing, where somebody's put in stocks, and then the people of the town come by and spit on them or throw tomatoes at them or whatever. Well, that's literally what happened to Jeremiah on that occasion. And he's willing to go through all of that. All of the people made fun of him, thought he was a nut. All he was doing was saying what God was going to do. They didn't want to believe it. And so here's how he's treated. Just one example of that. The next phrase, it talks about folks being stoned and sawn in two, and tempted and slain with the sword. In 2 Chronicles chapter 24, you have a mention of a priest by the name of Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, who, when he got up, he stood up and told the people they were not right and God was not pleased with them. And the people just conspired against him and stoned him right there in the temple area. So we think, again, sometimes we think that stoning, maybe that didn't occur all that much in the Old Testament. If there were people who lived lives of faith and got stoned for it. We know of examples of that, of course, in the New Testament as well. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It was, stoning was just brutal. I was talking to some of the young people at Athens Bible School just the other day about when somebody would lose their lives with stoning. I did a little research on it. It's just, if you can, you ever been hit by a rock? Anybody ever been hit by a rock? I have, just a little one. And I thought I was going to have to go to the hospital. Very just painful, that one whack and draws a little bit of blood, and you think, well, you know, that, but think about, you know, rocks as big as your hand, softball-sized rocks, and just one after the other. Some of the research I did on it suggested that it took a person 10 to 20 minutes usually to lose consciousness. Can you imagine being pelted from all angles with just one blow after another? And you're aware of it for that long a period of time. And you know, blood and contusions everywhere, and then finally you lose the consciousness, and finally they heap enough stones on you to kill you. But it's just the most brutal thing. And somebody to willingly stand up for their faith and endure something like that, just tremendous. You think about, you know, their physical circumstances, wearing sheepskins and goatskins. We might have this sort of strange idea that everybody in ancient times wore sheepskins and goatskins. Well, no. A lot of people were dressed in very fine apparel. But there were folks who were nomadic or who gave up lives of luxury, like perhaps Moses, who could have had very fine clothing and that sort of thing, but he gives that up and wanders around in the desert. And so it's talking about those kind of people. It mentions them wandering in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. I can think of a number of people of faith in the Old Testament, can you, that had to spend time in caves? Can you name me a couple? David many times, right? I mentioned Elijah that I know of. Okay. Yeah. I think you might go through and find that others in the time of the judges, there were some that had to go into caves and some various things like that. So what the text says is about all of these people that the world was not worthy of them. And it truly was not. But the thing is, they didn't mind, because they weren't here for this world. They were here for the next world. And the text is really leading us to that conclusion. The world wasn't worthy of them, but as really it's already said, they were looking for a city. They were looking for something beyond this world. Very, very encouraging and inspirational. Let's read the last couple of verses of the chapter. As it says, of whom the world was not worthy in verse 38, they wandered in deserts, mountains, and dens and caves of the earth. And verse 39 says, and all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So because of their lives of faith, we say tremendous things about these people, and they offer for us beautiful examples of what faith is all about. They explain to us what faith is all about. And we say these wonderful things about them. Wonderful things about them are said in inspired writings. And yet, they did not receive the promise. What promise? What's he talking about? They did all of this, but they never really received the ultimate reward, at least not yet. Right? Okay. So they're still maybe waiting for that? What promise do you think he's talking about? Looking forward to that? And then eternity after that. I think that whole ball of wax probably is involved there. So they're looking. And the thing is, he says in the next verse, that God, having provided something better for us, that's what all of Hebrews is about. That we now have this better, perfected relationship with God through Jesus Christ. That's the only way you're going to get this beautiful, complete relationship where you can actually go into the presence of God and have this relationship with Him. They didn't have any of that, did they? So their relationship with God was not perfected while they were here on earth, and they didn't achieve eternity in the final analysis yet either. They will, but they haven't as of yet. So the picture that we have when we open up chapter 12 in just a minute, where are these people in the next couple of verses? We are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses as we run our race. They've already finished their race, but they haven't received their crowns yet, have they? They're still waiting in the stands. They're still waiting in the stands for us to finish. Without our race being finished and us receiving our crowns, their whole race isn't finished either. They're waiting in the stands for us to finish. We're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. And I think then we can go on maybe to the next lesson, which is lesson 20, if you're following along your lesson sheets, and look at these people in chapter 12. Therefore it says, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So this great cloud of witnesses, they're, if you will, cheering us on. Not only, I think, perhaps that is true, but maybe the bigger point that the Hebrew writer is trying to make is that they're here surrounding us, waiting for us to finish. And the fact that they have run their race and done what they have done should be an inspiration for us to finish. I think all of that maybe goes into what the writer is saying here. Well, we have this great cloud of people of faith. They showed us what faith was. They showed us how to live lives of faith. As going back to the end of chapter 10, the just shall live by faith. They've shown us what that's all about. And now, well, let's do that. Let's run our race, laying aside the weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Now, some of the translations may kind of combine weight and sin. And in the Greek, it's six of one, half of the other, half a dozen of the other, how you read that. But it could be the weight, even the sin, or the weight and the sin. I take it to be two different things, where you have weight that slows you down, that inhibits you, that may not be sinful in and of itself, and that could just be a whole lot of stuff that's in the world that's okay in and of itself, but it slows you down from running your race. And then you have the sin that ensnares you. It trips you up, and it keeps you from getting anywhere. Okay, so you got both of those things. You got to lay aside the weight, and then you have to avoid the sin, the traps along the way, so to speak. So it's not a clear track, is it? When Jesus said the way to eternal life was straight and narrow, when He said straight, He didn't mean straight, He meant difficult. Straight as in difficult, like the Straits of Magellan or something like that. Straight as in a hard place to go. Okay? So it's got a lot of bumps in it. It's got a lot of problems. Okay? Thank you, Tracy. All right. So we consider this great cloud of witnesses. We lay aside the excess weight. We run with, depending on what translation you use, endurance or patience. Strong's definition there says that means cheerful or hopeful endurance. I don't know where you get that word cheerful from. But, you know, if the end and the reward is significant enough, you can endure just about anything, can't you? That's what he's talking about. You endure it, and you can actually do so, not like, you know, some grumpy curmudgeon, but with a sense of happiness and joy. I think most of the time when you watch a race on TV, a marathon or something like that, have you ever noticed the faces of the runners? They don't look particularly happy, do they, most of the time? They look like they're in pain. That's why I never took up running. That just looks like a very painful thing to me. But you know, if you think about when they get to the end of the race, if they win, I mean, you see some joy then usually. So, but the thing is, what he's saying is we can run the whole race with this endurance, keep on keeping on, but with a little bit of joy in our hearts. And our example of that, we'll get to in just a second, of course, is Jesus, who for the joy that was set before Him, you know, He endured And so we can do this with some a positive outlook instead of always looking negatively, because there is a promised prize. In a race, everybody runs to receive the crown or the prize. 1 Corinthians 9:24. Paul says, "So run that you may obtain." You run to receive that crown. So you have that positive thought process. Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 7 and 8, I've fought the good fight, finished the course, kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me at that day, and not to me only, but unto all them also who love His appearing. So we have this crown of righteousness at the end of the race, and we look forward to receiving that. That moment when you're on the victor's stand and they put the medal on you and they crown you, in a spiritual sense, that's what keeps us going. And on top of that, we look to Jesus, who is, this translation says, the author and finisher of our faith. Those two words are pretty interesting words. They're translated a couple different ways, but I like author and finisher as far as the translation. The New King James has that. Maybe along with author, you might think of somebody who originates something, who begins it. That's really more the concept. In Revelation, Jesus is multiple times called the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. Okay? When it comes to our faith, He is the beginning and the end. He is the originator, the author, and then the other word is the finisher, or your translation may say perfecter or something like that. The one who completes it, the one who makes it perfect. So it's, you know, all the way through, he's everything. And so if you think about our faith, well, who else would you want to look for or look to? Who else would be your example other than here's the one who started it and here's the one who finished it and he's all through it? So look to Jesus, the author and finisher of, and the word that he uses is faith. He's the author and the finisher of faith. Well, the whole last chapter and a half, that's what we've been talking about. Faith. Well, here's the fellow who's the beginning and end of that. So let's look to him. Well, what did he do? For the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. Talk about enduring something. See, this is all about enduring. We're trying to endure a race of faith in our lives. Christ endured the cross for the joy set before him. Now, let's have a little discussion. What do you think that might be, the joy set before him? That's why he did it. Accomplish what God sent him to do, which would, pleasing his Father. That always made me happy to please my dad. Doug? Yeah. He was going back to, as the text will say, sit at the right hand of God. And so that's something to look forward to. So all of that together, and I don't think a lot of you read commentators and scholars on that and they want to pinpoint one thing or other. And I think sometimes that's a mistake when I think that's probably the reason that a phrase like the joy set before him, because a lot of things can cause joy, can it? Right? And sometimes when you're happy, you might not even know all the reasons that you're happy. There may just be so many reasons when you have joy. And it's the same thing when you're sad. If you think about the last time you cried, you might not remember, was it just one thing? Probably not. About half a dozen things, probably. So there's a lot of, so I think that's intended here. The joy set before him included probably all of that. But he endures the cross, despising the shame. And I wanted you to think about, as I asked the questions in your question sheet, a little bit about the shame of the cross. And that's going to be kind of important when we get later on into chapter 12, a little further. What was the cross in the mind of ancient people? How did people... How was it viewed if you were put to death on a cross? It was very shameful. One of the most ignominious, I think, ways to die that was ever created by the carnal minds of men. But you think about, you know, being stripped naked and beaten within an inch of your life, and then nailed, and then raised up on as a spectacle. And the Romans would virtually always crucify somebody on a cross on the main road in and out of a town. It's just so everybody could pass by and see that. And so it's the most humiliating thing that you could ever think about. Romans themselves were not crucified on crosses. It was considered, Cicero wrote, as a death for slaves and foreigners. It was so humiliating. It was one of the privileges of being a Roman citizen that even if you were condemned to death, you wouldn't die that way. But slaves and foreigners, and of course, Jesus being a Jew would have been considered a foreigner. He endures this, completely innocent man, condemned actually of nothing. Not even Pilate condemns him of anything. I find no fault in this man, he says. And yet, Christ is going through this humiliation. I want to read just parts of three verses to you just real quickly. Acts 8:33, talking about the crucifixion. In his humiliation, his justice was taken away. You ever thought about that phrase? His humiliation. Galatians 3:13, Christ has become a curse for us. As it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. In Galatians 5 and verse 11, Paul mentions the offense of the cross. It was an offending thing, an embarrassing thing to be crucified on a cross. So here's Jesus. He endures this. We got any excuse to quit running our race? I don't think so. See, if the author and finisher of our faith was able to go through that, then I think we can handle sort of whatever is sent our way. And that's the next point that I believe he wants us to consider. If you look at verse 3, consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. See, no matter how bad we got it, have we had to go to the nth degree that Christ did? We haven't. None of us have done that. What have we got to complain about? You know, basically, is what's being said. Here, we've not resisted to the bloodshed, striving against sin like Jesus did. And so, if he can do it, we can do it. He went far beyond what we're going to have to do. And so, run your race. Look to this one who's the author and finisher. Is basically what's being said. We've not had to shed our blood in striving against sin. Thoughts or questions on that? Or anybody have something they want to throw in here? Sir. Right. The idea is again that same word. I think author. He's originated it for us. We got to follow it. We need to do what he said and follow his ways. Good point. All right. As we run with discipline. And let's look at verses 5-11. Let's back up to 4 to kind of get the running start at this. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed, for a few days, chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Chastening or discipline is training through teaching, rebuke, correction, and or affliction. It is what we do for and to our children. Okay? So the word that's translated chastening or discipline in this context over and over again, that's really what it means. In this context, it primarily connotes negative sort of discipline or chastening. The punishment part, the affliction part of it. Okay? The spanking, the whipping, the beating, the scourging, that sort of thing. So, you start out and it says that we don't need to despise the Lord's chastening or be discouraged when we are rebuked by Him. Because when He chastens us, what is He treating us as? His children. Yeah. He's treating us as His children. And just the whole point of this is, of course, just as we've had human fathers, we have our Heavenly Father who chastens us. What son is there whom their father does not chasten? Now, how does the chastening, we need to stop here and talk about how does the chastening of the Lord occur? I was teaching this class many, many years ago. Not this class, this chapter. You weren't there. I was teaching this chapter many years ago, and somebody stopped me right in the middle of it and said, well, as far as he knew, that the only way that the Lord chastened us was by and through His inspired Word. And I was taken aback by that at the moment and really didn't know how to answer it. But first of all, in the context, the chastening is not by the inspired Word that's under consideration. The difficulties that we face in running our race, that's what's led to the discussion of the chastening. The weight, okay, the trials, that's what the chastening is in this context. Now, to be sure, God disciplines us by and through His Word. In Revelation chapter 3, in verse 19, Jesus said to the church at Laodicea, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Okay? So rebuke, which is an oral correction, right? As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. So it's definitely through His Word that chastening comes. And you have a lot of Old Testament passages, Psalm 119, that would suggest the same thing. But also through the afflictions of life, the trials of life, the difficulties of life, that's probably more in the Hebrews 12 context, what's being talked about. You remember Paul in 2 Corinthians 12, the thorn in the flesh. Y'all remember that? A thorn in the flesh was sent, a messenger of Satan, he says, to buffet, to beat me. Yep. It was sent. Now, what do we say one of the parts of chastening is? Is beating. Right? So Paul says, here's an affliction I have, and the very purpose of the affliction is to give me a beating, to give me discipline. The very purpose of that affliction. Now, you know, somebody wants to talk about Satan's trying to harm God's people and do a lot of things like that. I understand that. That's all true as well. But God uses a lot of different things. Scourge, yeah. It's obvious that it's a negative physical sort of punishment that is under consideration. So we go back, and here's how He chastens us. Sure, through His Word, and also through life experiences that may be somewhat negative, affliction, whatever. So we need to learn. And maybe I should back up also and say that this same concept is taught using different metaphors. I think about the fiery trial that, you know, purifies us of the dross and you know, heats us up and makes us purer and better. Same exact situation, just to make us better. individuals. It's illustrating the same thing that God does in our lives. Let me finish up this little section quickly, and then we'll quit. Our reaction to chastening... Maybe I can't finish it up. Hold on. Our reaction to chastening determines our relationship to God. If I won't accept His discipline, what does that say about my relationship with Him? I'm not legitimate. I'm not legitimately His child. I said, no, you're not my father. You can't chasten me. You ever had a kid do that to you? You know, somebody's acting up and it's not your child. And you say, if you don't stop it, I'm going to have to... You're not my daddy. You can't... You ever had a child tell you that? Yeah. Well, yeah. He didn't tell you again, though, did he, Doug? Yeah, I had that for one time, too. But, you know, there's a point to be made there. You know, we accept discipline from our parents. Most children with any sense, accept discipline from their parents, but they won't particularly accept it from others. Well, if we're refusing God's discipline, we're just saying to Him, you're not my father. We prove ourselves to be illegitimate children and not sons. Well, we need to kind of wind down and stop there. We're actually doing pretty well at getting caught back up. I do need to cover the rest of chapter 12 Sunday morning, Lord willing. So everybody come geared up to do that. I know we can do it. I have all the faith and confidence. But we're doing really well, and I appreciate you letting me rattle on and try to cover material pretty quickly.